The hangar deck was normally kept in vacuum. The doors were so huge that a certain amount of leakage was inevitable. Later, Cargill would supervise as hangar deck was put under pressure, but for now, he and Sinclair carried out their inspection in vacuum. Everything seemed in order, nothing out of place as they entered. "Now," said Cargill, "what would you fiddle with if you were a miniature Moti?" "I would put the boats on the hull and use the hangar deck as a fuel tank." "There are ships like that. Be a big job for a swarm of brownies, though." Cargill strolled out onto the hangar doors. He wasn't sure what he was looking for, and was never sure why he looked down at his feet. It took him a moment to realize that something was wrong. The crack that separated the two huge rectangular doors wasn't there. Cargill looked about him, bewildered. There was nothing. The doors were part of the hull. The hinge motors, weighing several tons apiece, had vanished.
"Sandy?"
"Aye?"
"Where are the doors?"
"Why, you're standing on them, you bloody—"
"I don't believe it.
They've sealed us in.
Why? How? How could they work in vacuum?"
Sinclair ran back to the airlock. "The airlock door controls."
"The instruments red-green," said Sinclair. "Everything's fine as far as they know. If the brownies can fool instruments, they could have had the hangar deck under pressure until just before we arrived."
"Try the doors."
Cargill swung up onto one of the retractable bracings.
"The instruments show the doors opening. Still opening.
Complete."
Sinclair turned around. Nothing. A vast expanse of beige-painted floor, as solid as any part of the hull. He heard Cargill curse. He saw Cargill swing down from the huge retractable brace and drop onto what had been a hangar door. He saw Cargill drop through the floor as if it had been the surface of a pond. They had to fish Cargill out of the Langston field. He was chest-deep in formless black quicksand and sinking, his legs very cold, his heart beating very slowly. The field absorbed all motion.
"I should have got my head into it," he said when he came round. "That's what all the manuals say. Get my brain to sleep before my heart slows down. But God's teeth! How could I think?"
"What happened?" Sinclair asked.
Cargill's mouth opened, closed, opened again. He managed to sit up.
"There aren't words. It was like a miracle. It was like I was walking on water when they took away my sainthood. Sandy, it was really the damnedest thing. It looked a mite peculiar, too." "I bet. You see what they did, don't you? The little bastards are redesigning MacArthur. The doors are still there, but the ships can go through them now. In an emergency, you don't even have to evacuate hangar deck."
"I'll tell the captain," Sinclair said. He turned to the intercom.
"Where the hell did they hide?"
Cargill demanded. The engineering ratings who had pulled him out stared blankly. So did Sinclair.
"Where? Where didn't we look?"
His legs still felt cold. He massaged them. On the screen, he could see Rod Blaine's pained expression. Cargill struggled to his feet. As he did, alarms hooted through the ship.
"Now hear this, intruder alert. All combat personnel will don battle armor. Marines, report to hangar deck with hand weapons and battle armor."
"The guns!"
Cargill shouted.
"I beg your pardon," Sinclair said.
Blaine's image focused on the first lieutenant.
"The guns, skipper! We did not look in the guns! Damn, I'm a bloody fool! Did anyone think of the guns?"
"It may be," Sinclair agreed. "Captain, I request that you send for the ferrets."
"Too late, chief," Blaine said. "There's a hole in their cage. I already checked."
"God damn,"
Cargill said.
He said it reverently.
"God damn them."
He turned to the armed Marines swarming onto hangar deck.
"Follow me."
He was through treating the miniatures as escaped pets, or as vermin. As of now, they were enemy boarders. They rushed forward to the nearest turret. A startled rating jumped from his post as the first lieutenant, chief engineer, and a squad of Marines in battle armor crammed into his control room. Cargill stared at the instrument board. Everything seemed normal. He hesitated in real fear before he opened the inspection hatch. The lenses and focus rings were gone from number 3 battery. The space inside was alive with brownies. Cargill jumped back in horror, and a thread of laser pulse splashed against his battle armor. He cursed and snatched a tank of cyphogene from the nearest marine and slammed it into the gap. It wasn't necessary to open the stopcock. The tank grew hot in his hand, and one laser beam winked through and past him. When the hissing died, he was surrounded by yellow fog. The space inside 3 battery was thick with dead miniatures and filthy with bones. Skeletons of rats, bits of electronic gear, old boots, and dead brownies.
"They kept a herd of rats in there!" Cargill shouted.
"Then they must have outgrown the herd and eaten them all. They've been eating each other!"
"And the other batteries!" Sinclair said in wonder. "We'd best be hasty."
There was a scream from the corridor outside. The Navy rating, who'd been displaced from his post, fell to the deck. A bright red stain appeared at his hip.
"In the ventilator!" he shouted.
A Marine corporal tore at the grating. Smoke flashed from his battle armor, and he jumped back.
"Nipped me, by God!"
He stared incredulously at a neat hole in his shoulder as 3 other Marines fired hand lasers at a rapidly vanishing shape. Somewhere else in the ship, an alarm sounded. Cargill grabbed an intercom.
"Skipper?"
"I know," Blaine said quickly. "Whatever you did has them stirred up all over the ship. There are a dozen firefights going on right now."
"My God, sir, what do we do?"
"Send your troops to number 2 battery to clean that out," Blaine ordered. "Then get to damage control." He turned to another screen. "Any other instructions, Admiral?" The bridge was alive with activity. One of the armored helmsmen jumped from his seat and whirled rapidly.
"Over there!"
he shouted. A Marine sentry pointed his brownie-altered weapon helplessly.
"You are not in control of your vessel," Kutuzov said flatly.
"No, sir." It was the hardest thing Blaine had ever had to say.
"Casualties in Corridor 20, the bridge talker announced.
"Scientist country," Rod said. "Get all available Marines into that area and have them assist the civilians into pressure suits. Maybe we can gas the whole ship."
"Captain Blaine, our first task is to return to Empire with maximum information."
"Yes, sir."
"Which means civilians aboard your vessel are more important than a battle cruiser."
Kutuzov was calm, but his lips were tight with distaste.
"Of second priority are Moti artifacts not yet transferred to Lenin. Captain, you will therefore order all civilians off your vessel. I will have Lenin's boats outside our protective field. You will have 2 reliable officers accompany civilians. You will then secure any Moti artifacts you think important for shipment to Lenin. You may attempt to regain control of your vessel, insofar as that is consistent with these orders, but you will also act swiftly, Captain. Because at first sign of any transmission from your vessel, other than through secure circuit direct to me, I will blast MacArthur out of space."
Blaine nodded coldly.
"Aye, aye, sir." "We understand each other, then."
The Admiral's expression didn't change at all.
"And Godspeed, Captain Blaine."
"What about my cutter?" Rod asked.
"Sir, I have to talk to the cutter."
"I will alert the cutter personnel, Captain."
"No. There will be no transmission from your ship."
"Aye, aye, sir." Rod looked around his bridge. Everyone was staring wildly about. The Marines' weapons were drawn, and one of the quartermasters was fussing over a fallen companion.
"Jesus, can I trust the intercom?"
Rod wondered. He shouted orders to a runner and waved 3 Marines to accompany the man.
"Signal from Mr. Renner, sir," the bridge talker announced.
"Don't acknowledge," Blaine growled.
"Aye, aye, sir. Do not acknowledge."
The battle for MacArthur raged on. 30. Nightmare. There were a dozen humans and 2 brown and whites aboard the cutter. The other ground party Motis had reported directly to the embassy ship, but Whitbreads and Sally's Fionchs had stayed aboard.
"No point," said Whitbread's Moti.
We've been seeing the decision-maker every day. Perhaps there was a point. The cutter was crowded, and the taxi to MacArthur had not arrived.
What's holding them up? Renner said.
Lafferty put in a call. Lafferty, the cutter's pilot, was largely unemployed these days. He used the communications beam.
No answer, sir, he said.
He sounded puzzled.
You're sure the set's working?
It was an hour ago, Lafferty said.
There's a signal. It's from Lenin, sir.
Captain Mikhailov's face appeared on the screen. You will please request aliens to leave this vessel, he said. Somehow the motis conveyed amusement, surprise, and a slightly hurt look all at once. They left with a backward look and a signaled query. Whitbread shrugged. Staley didn't. When the motis were in the airlock bridge, Staley closed the door behind them. Kutuzov appeared.
Mr. Renner, you will send all personnel aboard to Lenin. They will wear pressure suits, and one of my boats will arrive to get them. Civilians will cross on a line, and will then obey orders of my boat's pilot. They must carry sufficient air for 1 hour in space. Meanwhile, you will make no attempt to communicate with MacArthur. Is this understood?
Renner gulped.
Aye, aye, sir.
You will not admit aliens until further notice.
But what do I tell them, sir?
Renner asked.
You will tell them Admiral Kutuzov is a paranoid fool, Mr. Renner. Now, carry out your orders.
Aye, aye, sir.
The screen went blank. Renner looked pale. Now he's reading minds.
Kevin, what's going on here?
Sally demanded.
Get us up in the middle of the night, rush us up here. Now Rod won't answer us, and the Admiral wants us to risk our lives and offend the motis.
She sounded very much like Senator Fowler's niece, an imperial lady who had tried to cooperate with the Navy, and now had had enough. Dr. Horvath was even more indignant.
I will not be a party to this, Mr. Renner. I have no intention of putting on a pressure suit.
Lenin's moving alongside MacArthur, Whitbread said casually. He stared out the viewport. The Admiral has her ringed with boats. I think somebody's carrying a line over. Everyone turned to the viewports. Lafferty focused the cutter's telescope and flashed the results on the ship's bridge screens. After a while, figures in spacesuits began moving along lines toward Lenin's boats, which then moved away to let others take their places.
They're abandoning MacArthur, Staley said wonderingly.
He looked up, his angular face contorted.
And one of Lenin's boats is headed this way. My lady, you'll have to hurry. I don't think there's much time.
But I told you I am not going,
Dr. Horvath insisted. Staley fingered his pistol. The cabin grew tense.
Doctor, do you remember the orders Viceroy Merrill gave Admiral Kutuzov?
Renner asked carefully.
As I recall, he was to destroy MacArthur rather than let the motis obtain any important information.
Renner's voice was cool, almost bantering. Horvath tried to say something else. He seemed to be having difficulty controlling his features. Finally, he turned to the pressure suit locker without a word. After a moment, Sally followed him. Horace Berry had gone to his cabin after the coffee demonstration. He liked to work late at night and sleep after lunch, and although there wasn't anything to work on at the moment, he'd kept the habit. The ship's alarms woke him. Somebody was ordering the Marines into combat uniform. He waited, but nothing else happened for a long time. Then came the stench. It choked him horribly, and there was nothing like it in any of his memories. Distilled quintessence of machines and body odor, and it was growing stronger. More alarms sounded. Prepare for hard vacuum. All personnel will don pressure suits. All military personnel will don battle armor. Prepare for hard vacuum. Nabil was crying in panic.
Fool, your suit!
Barry screamed and ran for his own. Only after he was breathing normal ship's air did he listen for the alarms again. The voices didn't sound right. They weren't coming through the intercom. They were shouted through the corridors.
Civilians will abandon ship! All civilian personnel, prepare to abandon ship!
Really?
Barry almost smiled. This was a first time. Was it a drill? There were more sounds of confusion. A squad of Marines in battle armor, weapons clutched at the ready, tramped past. The smile slipped, and Barry looked about to guess what possessions he might save. There was more shouting. An officer appeared in the corridor outside and began shouting in an unnecessarily loud voice. Civilians would be leaving MacArthur on a line. They could take one bag each, but would require one hand free. Beard of the Prophet! What could cause this? Had they saved the golden asteroid metal? The superconductor of heat? Certainly they would not save the precious self-cleaning percolator. What should he try to save? The ship's gravity lessened noticeably. Flywheels inside her were rotating to take off her spin. Barry worked quickly to throw together items needed by any traveler, without regard to their price. Luxuries he could buy again, but the miniatures. He'd have to get that air tank from D Airlock. Suppose he were assigned to a different airlock. He packed in frenzy. Two suitcases, one for Nabil to carry. Nabil moved fast enough now that he had orders. There was more confused shouting outside, and several times squads of Navy men and Marines floated past the stateroom door. They all carried weapons and wore armor. His suit began to inflate. The ship was losing pressure, and all thought of drill or exercise left him. Some of the scientific equipment couldn't stand hard vacuum, and nobody had once come into the cabin to check his pressure suit. The Navy wouldn't risk civilian lives in drills. An officer moved into the corridor. Barry heard the harsh voice speaking in deadly calm tones. Nabil stood uncertainly, and Barry motioned to him to turn on his suit communications. All civilian personnel, go to your nearest airlocks on the port flank, the unemotional voice said. The Navy always spoke that way when there was a real crisis. It convinced Barry utterly. Civilian evacuation will be through port side locks only. If you are unsure of your direction, ask any officer or rating. Please proceed slowly. There is time to evacuate all personnel. The officer floated past and turned into another corridor. Port side? Good. Intelligently, Nabil had hidden the dummy tank in the nearest airlock. Praise to the glory of Allah, that had been on the port side. He motioned to his servant and began to pull himself from handhold to handhold along the wall. Nabil moved gracefully. He had had plenty of practice since they had been confined. There was a confused crowd in the corridor. Behind him, Barry saw a squad of Marines turn into the corridor. They faced away and fired in the direction they'd come. There was answering fire, and bright blood spurted to form ever-diminishing globules as it drifted through the steel ship. The lights flickered overhead. A petty officer floated down the corridor and fell in behind them. Keep moving, he muttered. God bless the Joeys. What are they shooting at? Barry asked. Miniatures, the petty officer growled. If they take this corridor, move out fast, Mr. Barry. The little bastards have weapons. Brownies? Barry asked incredulously. Brownies? Yes, sir, the ship's got a plague of the little sons of bitches. They changed the air plants to suit themselves. Get moving, sir, please. Them Joeys can't hold long. Barry tugged at a handhold and sailed to the end of the corridor, where he was deftly caught by an able spacer and passed around the turn. Brownies? But they'd been cleared out of the ship. There was a crowd bunched at the airlock. More civilians were coming, and now non-combatant Navy people began to add to the press. Barry pushed and clawed his way toward the air bottle locker. Ah, it was still there. He seized the dummy and handed it to Nabil, who fastened it to Barry's suit. "That won't be necessary, sir," an officer said. Barry realized he was hearing him through atmosphere. There was pressure here, but they hadn't come through any pressure-tight doors. The Brownies. They'd made the invisible pressure barrier that the miner had on her survey ship. He had to have it. One never knows, Barry muttered to the officer. The man shrugged and motioned another pair into the cycling mechanism. Then it was Barry's turn. The Marine officer waved them forward. The lock cycled. Barry touched Nabil on the shoulder and pointed. Nabil went, pulling himself along the line into the blackness outside. Blackness ahead, no stars, nothing. What was out there? Barry found himself holding his breath.
Praise be to Allah. I witness that Allah is one.
No! The dummy bottle was on his shoulders, and inside it, two miniatures in suspended animation. Wealth untold. Technology beyond anything even the First Empire ever had. An endless stream of new inventions and design improvements, only just what kind of gin bottle had he opened? They were through the tightly controlled hole in MacArthur's field. Outside was only the blackness of space, and a darker black shape ahead. Other lines led to it from other holes in MacArthur's field. Minuscule spiders darted along them. Behind Barry was another space-suited figure, and behind that, another. Nabil and the others ahead of him, and his eyes were adjusting rapidly now. He could see the deep red hues of the coal sack, and the blot ahead must be Lenin's field. Would he have to crawl through that? But no, there were boats outside it, and the space spiders crawled into them. The boat was drawing near. Barry turned for a last look at MacArthur. In his long lifetime, he had said goodbye to countless temporary homes. MacArthur had not been the best of them. He thought of the technology that was being destroyed, the brownie improved machinery, the magical coffee pot. There was a twinge of regret. MacArthur's crew was genuinely grateful for his help with the coffee, and his demonstration to the officers had been popular. It had gone well, perhaps in Lenin. The airlock was tiny now. A string of refugees followed him along the line. He could not see the cutter, where his Moti would be. Would he ever see him again? He was looking directly at the space-suited figure behind him. It had no baggage, and it was overtaking Barry because it had both hands free. The light from Lenin was shining on its faceplate. As Barry watched, the figure's head shifted slightly, and the light shone right into the faceplate. Barry saw at least three pairs of eyes staring back at him. He glimpsed the tiny faces. It seemed to Barry later that he had never thought so fast in his life. For a heartbeat, he stared at the thing coming up on him while his mind raced, and then? But the men who heard his scream said that it was the shriek of a madman, or a man being flayed alive. Then Barry flung his suitcase at it. He put words into his next scream.
They're in the suit! They're inside it!
He was wrenching at his back now, ripping the air tank loose. He poised the cylinder over his head in both hands and pitched it. The pressure suit dodged his suitcase clumsily, a pair of miniatures in the arms trying to maneuver the fingers. It lost its handhold, tried to pull itself back. The metal cylinder took it straight in the faceplate and shattered it. Then space was filled with tiny struggling figures, flailing six limbs, as a ghostly puff of air carried them away. Something else went with them, something football-shaped, something Barry had the knowledge to recognize. That was how they had fooled the officer at the airlocks, a severed human head. Barry discovered he was floating 3 meters from the line. He took a deep, shuddering breath. Good. He'd thrown the right air tank. Allah was merciful. He waited until a man-shaped thing came out of Lenin's boat on backpack jets and took him in tow. The touch made him flinch. Perhaps the man wondered why Barry peered so intently into his faceplate. Perhaps not. 31. Defeat. MacArthur lurched suddenly. Rod clawed at the intercom and shouted,
"Chief Sinclair, what are you doing, Chief?"
The reply was barely audible.
"'Tis nae my doing, Captain. I had nae control of the altitude jets, and precious little of anything else."
"Oh, Lord God," Blaine said. Sinclair's image faded from the screens. Other screens faded. Suddenly the bridge was dead. Rod tried alternate circuits. Nothing.
"Computer inactivated," Crawford reported. "I get nothing at all."
Try the direct wire. Get me Cargill, Rod told his talker.
I have him, Captain.
Jack, what's the situation back there?
Bad, Skipper. I'm besieged in here, and I don't have communications except for direct wires. Not all of them.
MacArthur lurched again as something happened aft.
Captain?
Cargill reported excitedly.
Lieutenant Piper reports the Brownies are fighting each other in the main crew kitchen. Real pitched battle.
Jesus, Number One. How many of those monsters do we have aboard?
Skipper, I don't know. Hundreds, maybe. They must have hollowed out every gun on the ship, and they've spread to everywhere else, too. They're...
Cargill's voice cut off.
Jack!
Rod shouted.
Talker, have we got an alternate line to the First Lieutenant?
Before the quartermaster's mate could answer, Cargill came on the line again.
Close one, Skipper. Two armed miniatures came out of the auxiliary fire control computer. We killed them.
Blaine thought furiously. He was losing all his command circuits, and he didn't know how many men he had left. The computer was bewitched. Even if they did regain possession of MacArthur, there was a good chance she couldn't be made spaceworthy again.
You still on, Number One?
Yes, sir.
I'm going down to the airlock to talk to the Admiral. If I don't call you in 15 minutes, abandon ship. 15 minutes, Jack. Mark.
Aye, aye, sir.
And you can start rounding up the crew now. Portside only, Jack. That is, if she stays oriented where she is. The lock officers have orders to close the holes in the field if she shifts.
Rod motioned to his bridge crew and began working his way toward the airlocks. The corridors were in confusion. Yellow clouds filled several. Cyphogene. He'd had hopes for ending the Moti threat with gas, but it hadn't worked, and he didn't know why. The Marines had ripped out a number of bulkheads and barricaded themselves behind the debris. They poised watchfully, weapons ready.
"Civilians out?"
Rod asked the officer in charge of the lock.
"Yes, sir, far as we know. Skipper, I had the men make one sweep through that territory, but I don't like to risk another. The Brownies are thick in civilian country, like they were living there or something."
"Maybe they were, Piper," Blaine said. He moved to the airlock and oriented his suit toward Lennon. The communication laser winked on, and he hung in space, holding himself steady to keep the security circuit open.
"Your situation?"
Kutuzov demanded.
Reluctantly, knowing what it would mean, Rod told him.
"Recommended action?"
the Admiral snapped.
"MacArthur may never sail again, sir. I think I'll have to abandon her and scuttle as soon as I've made a sweep to rescue any trapped crewmen."
"And where will you be?"
"Leading the rescue party, sir."
"No."
The voice was calm.
"I accept your recommendation, Captain. But you are hereby ordered to abandon your ship. Log that order, Commander Borman,"
he added to someone on his bridge.
"You will issue the order to abandon and scuttle. Turn over command to your First Lieutenant and report aboard Lenin's Number 2 cutter. Immediately."
"Sir, sir, I request permission to remain with my ship until my crew is safe."
"Denied, Captain,"
the merciless voice snapped.
"I am quite aware that you have courage, Captain. Have you enough to live when you lose your command?"
"Sir."
Oh, God damn him to hell. Rod turned toward MacArthur, breaking the secure circuit. There was fighting at the airlock. Several miniatures had dissolved the bulkhead opposite the Marines' barricade, and the Joeys were pouring fire into the gap. Blaine gritted his teeth and turned away from the battle.
"Admiral, you cannot order me to leave my crew and run."
"I cannot? You find it hard to live now, Captain? You think they will whisper about you the rest of your life, and you are afraid of that? And you tell this to me? Carry out your orders, Captain, my Lord Blaine."
"No, sir."
"You disobey direct order, Captain?"
"I can't accept that order, sir. She's still my ship."
There was a long pause.
"Your devotion to Navy tradition is admirable, Captain, but stupid. It is possible that you are only officer in Empire who can devise defense against this menace. You know more about aliens than anyone else in fleet. That knowledge is worth more than your ship. It is worth more than every man aboard your ship, now that civilians are evacuated. I cannot allow you to die, Captain. You will leave that ship, even if I am required to send new commanding officer into her."
"He'd never find me, Admiral. Excuse me, sir, I have work to do."
"Stop!"
There was another pause.
"Very well, Captain.
I will make agreement with you. If you will stay in communication with me, I will allow you to remain aboard MacArthur until you have abandoned and scuttled. At instant that you are no longer in communication with me, that is moment at which you no longer command MacArthur. Need I send Commander Borman there?
The trouble is, Rod thought, he's right. MacArthur's doomed. Cargill can get the crew out as well as I can. Maybe I do know something important.